Stay tuned now on 1460 WVOX for The Ballot Box with your hosts, Tamar Tate and Nita Lubin. The Ballot Box is a monthly program brought to you by the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle. Now, The Ballot Box on 1460 WVOX.
Good morning on this final day of summer of 2022, and welcome to The Ballot Box. I'm Tamar Tate, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nina Lubin, and we're coming to you after a summer hiatus on behalf of the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle, and courtesy of WVOX, 1460 AM, and our talented sound engineer, Gerald Bell. So, Nina, how have you been? How was your summer?
I'm well, Tamar, thanks, and summer was good. A cautious opening, visiting friends and family a little bit near and a little bit far after the height of the pandemic now being over. A breath of fresh air. It was nice. You?
Great. Too short. Definitely too short. But before we leap into our show, I just want to remind our listeners we have an important election coming up on November 8th. And because of redistricting, there are some new people running for office here in New Rochelle and in some of the surrounding communities. So please be sure that you're registered to vote. October 14th is the last day to register, and October 24th is the last day to apply for an absentee ballot. So if you need any help getting registration forms or figuring out how to get an absentee ballot, please feel free to reach out to the League of Women Voters. I also want to inform our listeners that the League will be hosting a virtual candidate forum on October 25th at 7 p.m., and that will be between Assemblymember Amy Paulin, she is of the 88th District, and challenger Thomas Fix Jr. We'll provide more information on how to access that forum on the next ballot box, so now, turning to today's show, Nina and I, I'm assuming you went to the beach this summer. In my beach bag this summer, Nina and I, we compared notes. We found ourselves riveted by a new chronicle of the struggle of the women's movement in this country over the past 100 years. Formidable, American Women and the Fight for Equality by Elizabeth Griffith weaves together a group of fascinating stories of women, both familiar and not so familiar. And it takes a really close look at the role of race, class, and religion over the last century of women's activism. As the New York Times noted in its review, feminist history tends to be synonymous with white women's history. Not this book. Griffith delivers a multiracial, inclusive timeline of the struggles and triumphs of both black and white women in America. It's a tremendous read, and I'd highly recommend it to all our listeners. And today, The Ballot Box is really pleased to have Miss Griffith with us to discuss her remarkable definitive book, Formidable.
Hey, let me add to Tamar's review of Formidable that the book is a very readable font of information presented roughly decade by decade over the last 100 years in short vignettes that read like stories but are, in fact, history. For the fact-minded reader, the book has almost 100 pages of source citations at its end. But for those simply seeking to learn more about women who helped build this nation, women whose names you already know, and women whose names we guarantee you do not know, the book offers true story after story. For those interested in American history in general, the larger contexts that Betsy Griffith provides, politics, science, fashion, space travel, music, art, they bring each decade alive. So if it's not already clear how much Tamar and I learned from and enjoyed this book, well, we did. Elizabeth Griffith earned her PhD from the American University and an undergraduate degree from Wellesley College. She's been a Kennedy Fellow at Harvard's Institute of Politics and a Klingenstein Fellow at Columbia Teachers College. Dr. Griffith has spent her career working for women's rights as an activist, an academic, teaching women's history at secondary and college levels, and has written for the New York Times, the Washington Post, and professional journals. She's currently teaching courses in women's history through the Smithsonian and through the renowned independent Washington, D.C. bookstore, Politics and Prose. She is the author of In Her Own Right, The Life of Elizabeth Cady Stanton, which was, in fact, the inspiration for Ken Burns' PBS documentary called Not For Ourselves Alone.
And a fellow New Rochellian.
And
she lived here in New Rochelle.
That's news. That is news. Thank you. Okay. Moving on with the introduction. Welcome, Elizabeth Griffith, and thank you for joining us this morning on the Ballot Box.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here, and I'm especially pleased by your connection with the League of Women Voters, because it has played such a significant role in the advancement of women in American history, but even before it was called the League of Women Voters, when it was the National American Woman Suffrage Association, headed by Carrie Chapman Catt, really the strategic brains of the success of the suffrage movement. And then since 1920, I'd say really from 1920 until 1970, the majority of women who served in the Congress who did not have college degrees would say that they were graduates of the League of Women Voters because they had learned so much in your organization.
Well, that's great to know. I mean, we're constantly having forums and events for people to educate themselves, and the end goal is for women to really take that and get involved, grassroots up all the way up to Congress.
I just heard your spur to people to register, to make sure they were ready to vote in November. That's what every person should do. If they knew the history of how hard it was for women and blacks and others to get the vote in America, you would never not vote.
Right, right. That comes through loud and clear in the book. It's we owe it to the past to keep voting. Betsy, turning to the book, your author's note at the start begins with the line, quote, "There has always been more than one American story," close quote. It seems these days in particular, we are witnessing a slew of competing American stories. Can you explain what you meant by those words?
Well, I was, from a scholar's point of view, you can see the writing of American history as the increasing inclusion of different kinds of Americans. And I like what you said at the beginning about my book being both story and history. I think, of course, history is good storytelling, a fact-based storytelling. But we all remember, at least I'm old enough to remember, that the textbooks used when I was growing up were all about white male leaders, admirable, mostly admirable people, some less so, but they were taking over a continent. They were creating governments. They were winning wars and establishing economic institutions, running for president. So it's a very white, male-based history into the 1950s, when actually the GI Bill allowed different kinds of people to go to college, still white men, but white men from backgrounds in urban areas or farms or whose parents had been factory laborers. So you begin to, people wrote different kinds of history that talked about not only generals, but members of the military, not only industrialists, but labor people, wrote about immigrants, wrote about different issues in our country, and eventually African Americans would go to graduate school and eventually women. And now recent immigrants are going, Native Americans are going, many more people are going to graduate school in history, and all those people have different stories to tell. The other thing that influences how history is written is the availability of sources.
Okay, Betsy, let's hold on to this thought while we go for our first commercial break. Speak to everyone at the other end.
Let's return now to the Ballot Box with your hosts, Tamar Tate and Nita Lubin, brought to you by the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle. Once again, the Ballot Box on 1460 WVOX.
Welcome back. Our guest is Betsy Griffith, author of Formidable, American Women and the Fight for Equality. Betsy, picking up where we left off, you were pointing out to us that many stories comprise our American history, and I'd like to explore one of those stories with which you kick off the book. Formidable begins with the passage of the 19th Amendment, granting women the right to vote in 1920, which was 72 years after the first formal women's rights convention in America. And you note that, quote, the drive for women's rights came from the abolition movement. Could you please connect the dots for us between those two movements and explain the significance of their relationship?
Yes. And I need to go back one decade sooner than that. Abolition is the 1830s, but in the 1820s, after the growth of cities in America, we've been a pretty rural country until the War of 1812, and the British blockade of our ports led to manufacturing in this country. And so you begin to have small towns become bigger towns, they have factories, and they develop urban problems early on that people are concerned about, that in a small town, the minister, the ladies' committee would have resolved. So there's a push for reform, that people should be active in these larger areas. It's inspired by a religious revival. So they're dealing with widows and orphans and people injured in factories and drunkenness and prostitution. But the ministers clearly identify, northern ministers, that the largest sin in America is the sin of slavery, and we need to resolve it by abolishing the enslavement of African Americans. And so throughout the North, in the 1830s, the most white liberal men, the most liberal white men, white women, most of them Quakers, and freed black men and women, worked together to form abolition organizations. But these most liberal men were a little dismissive of the participation of women. They thought it would undermine their cause if they allowed women to be members. But then women like Sarah and Angelina Grimke, who were the daughters of South Carolina slaveholders, come to town and want to talk about the realities of slavery. But it was only appropriate for women to speak in women's groups. To speak to a co-ed group was viewed as promiscuous. So the women thought, we're not being treated fairly by these white men. We should think about our own rights. Clearly no comparison at all between the lives of white women and the lives of enslaved black men and women. But there were the issues of ownership, not being a person, a legally recognized individual, not being able to have control over your body. You didn't have rights to your children or your inherited property or your earnings. Women were legally invisible, and that begins to stir the idea for women's rights. Lucretia Mott and Elizabeth Cady Stanton are attending the World Anti-Slavery Convention in London in 1840. Mrs. Mott is representing the Philadelphia Female Anti-Slavery Society, and she is not allowed to be seated among these august reformers. So the two women begin to plot that they really need to address women's rights in America, and that will result in the Seneca Falls meeting. The Seneca Falls meeting gets historic credit for being a first, a marker, but it's only because it was an organization, an actual convention meeting of 300 people. But the idea had been stirring long before that. And one of the reasons I write about it is because there's an intersection between black and white reformers, change agents, causes throughout American history. And sometimes they work, these women change agents work as allies and sometimes on completely parallel tracks.
It's interesting that at a freedom conference or convention that women weren't allowed to speak. They weren't free to speak only because they were women. One of the ironies.
Right, and you mentioned that they were considered promiscuous as public speakers, but they were also on stage in theater, sometimes, you know, not clothed completely. And there's that little bit of hypocrisy. In the view of women.
Lots of hypocrisies, lots of irony. One of the measures passed at the Seneca Falls Convention. There were resolutions, all passed unanimously, except for the one that women ought to have the right to vote. And one of them was that women should be allowed to speak in public, mm-hmm. since men didn't seem to mind when they were in a burlesque or at the circus.
Right.
But they objected when they were speaking seriously.
Right, right. So speaking of these many women who worked quietly behind the scenes in their efforts to achieve social justice, one stellar example is Frances Perkins, who was the first woman to serve in a presidential cabinet position, which alone is quite a feat. But you note that Perkins' signature accomplishment was the Social Security Act of 1935, which, of course, is generally credited to Franklin Delano Roosevelt. So, would you please dive into the details of her appointment as Secretary of Labor and the conditions that she imposed on President Roosevelt before accepting his offer?
Before working first for Governor Roosevelt in 1928 and then for President Roosevelt in 1932, both appointments lobbied for by his wife, Eleanor, and her friend, Molly Dewson, Democratic power woman, she had conditions for him. She was very experienced in labor and in working on behalf of labor union people. She had graduated from Mount Holyoke. She'd worked with Jane Addams at the Hull House in Chicago, but she was in New York City in 1911 at the site of the Triangle factory fire, mm-hmm. just by coincidence, and sees these young women, mostly teenage Jewish immigrants, jumping to their death because the fire escapes had been closed by the factory owners. And from that moment on, she becomes an advocate of protecting labor people in factories. So she says to Franklin Roosevelt, I'm clearly the most qualified person for this job, but I'm only doing this if you will support Social Security, Fair Labor Standards Act. She had several issues on her agenda, and he agreed to all of them, not all that enthusiastically. She is the only member of his cabinet who stays through all four administrations, and she is very successful. One of the reasons she was successful is that Frances Perkins believed in a modest approach to men. That if you, despite that exchange with FDR, she was on the whole.
We're going to take a break right now. I'm sorry to interrupt, but we'll pick up when we get back. Thank you.
Let's return now to The Ballot Box with your hosts, Tamar Tate and Nita Lubin, brought to you by the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle. Once again, The Ballot Box on 1460 WVOX.
Welcome back. We are talking with Elizabeth Griffith, author of the recently published book, Formidable, American Women and the Fight for Equality. And I'm afraid we left both Elizabeth and our listeners dangling with that commercial break. We were talking about Frances Perkins, President Roosevelt's Secretary of Labor, who managed to achieve an awful lot in the realm of social justice during that time. And Betsy, you were telling us about her secret sauce.
I wanted to just conclude about Secretary Perkins that she was a smart and attractive woman, and she purposely made herself dowdy and quiet because she felt she would be more effective working with men if they did not feel threatened by her. She just kept working in and out all the in every way she could to advance the rights of working Americans. And
I think that was an effective strategy. Betsy, I think you said in your book that she deliberately tried to dress that way because it made men think there was a resemblance to their mothers and that they would listen better if they felt that she was someone to be regarded as their mother.
Exactly right, and it worked. It's just indicative of the power of sexism, the power of patriarchy, that women for so long needed to work behind the scenes. Not only white women who were sort of safe in a public sphere, but black women who were physically endangered when they took on public causes.
You know, moving from the 1930s and 40s into the 50s and 60s, and it's a good time to segue into the civil rights movement, one of the women that you profiled in your book is someone that neither Nina nor I had heard of before, Daisy Gadsden Bates. You wrote that she was the force behind the integration of Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas in 1957. Who was she, and how important was she in the lives of the students who faced desegregation by fire?
In the Black community of Arkansas, she would have been very well known as a leader in the NAACP, which membership in which was frequently illegal in southern states. She owned a newspaper that she published and took on this cause, first almost as an investigative journalist, interviewing families who had, after the Brown decision, Black families who had applied to send their children to the Central High School in Little Rock. She finally pushes the case through, gets permission from the school superintendent, and recruits 16 students. Some of them lost courage, understandably, and so the Little Rock Nine approached that school on the first day and were met with more than 1,000 people screaming and spitting on them, these angry white people. And so they retreat, but every day for that entire year, they were taken to school by Daisy Bates and returned to her home to do their homework and to be safeguarded before she drove them to their own homes. They were terribly treated. Eisenhower calls in the National Guard to protect them so that they are escorted into school and they have protection officers with them in the school. But one young woman said that she never went to the bathroom during the school day because the National Guard's person could not protect her inside the girls' room and she would be beaten up. Not only were the students horribly treated, but their parents lost their jobs or were threatened, and almost every night Mrs. Bates's house was attacked by members of the Ku Klux Klan. The city of Little Rock and the state of Arkansas thought that this was too disruptive, and so the public schools closed for the entire next year. No one went to school so that they would not have to include these Black students. Daisy Bates, she'll have to leave Arkansas. She ends up assisting both the Kennedy and the Johnson administration. She'll eventually return to Arkansas. And I love this sort of closure to the story. You all know that every state gets to send two statues to be exhibited in the rotunda of the Capitol. And Arkansas is currently represented by two gentlemen from the middle of the 19th century. But they are replacing them with Daisy Bates and Johnny Cash. So more people will... More people will learn about Daisy Bates because they'll see her in person, so to speak.
Absolutely. I've seen the pictures of the students under fire being led into the school, the dogs, the angry faces, the snarling faces. And I never stopped to ask, how did these students get through this? Not just the first day, but for a year of that. And to understand that there was a woman who took them in, drove them, counseled, guided them, gave them the strength to do this is, this extraordinary example of quietly behind the scenes in this case, someone that just didn't make it into our history books, but someone that is vastly responsible for the integration of this country.
That was
go ahead. As you both know from reading my book, I conclude that there's enormous changes for American women, but not enough. I think that we clearly have farther to go. But one of the big changes is that neither white nor Black nor LGBTQ or immigrant or all kinds of diversity of American women is as diverse as our country. But they don't have to make their political fights or their protests or their change agent action in behind the scenes anymore in some quiet way. They still, of course, confront opposition and people yelling at them and sometimes pushing and hurting them. But nonetheless, it's at least accepted that they have a public voice.
Yes, yes. And we're lucky enough to live in that era right now. On a lighter note, and actually a fashion note,
Well, that's one of the great things about this book, is it really covers the whole spectrum.
Exactly. But I think this will be news to an awful lot of people also. 1950s, we're back there, the new swimsuit. That's the rage of the 1950s beaches, the bikini. Can you do a really quick deep dive into the name and the name of the folks that wore that swimsuit?
The bikini was named for a Pacific atoll on which the atomic island had, or the atomic bomb had been tested. And so women who wore this scandalous, skimpy bathing suit, nowhere near as scandalous and skimpy as they are today, were called bombshells. Fashion is really a huge part of feminism, of women's liberation, because just being physically capable of movement, to be able to wear trousers, to be able to wear comfortable shoes, to not be encased in whalebone corsets or girdles or long line bras, as women were for so long. I mean, not only do I admire all those suffragists for being so courageous and being dragged off to jail and force-fed. I can't imagine the horror of that. But they were doing it with lots of underwear on and many layers of clothing.
Lots of constraining underwear.
Yes.
Well, I never knew, nor did I ask, where the word bombshell came from. But we know it's a descriptive of a, like, wowser female, and it comes from atomic bomb practice.
Yeah, this book is
Bikini
just
Island.
Chock full of illumination like that. I want to go back, because I loved all the stories you had about all these different women, and there were many that were names that were new to me, but there were also some big names like Eleanor Roosevelt. You know, her achievements loom very large in the narrative of powerful American women over the past century. And it was interesting to learn in your book that Mrs. Roosevelt was chair of the UN Human Rights Commission, which in its Universal Declaration of Human Rights recognized equality of the sexes, but then she continued to oppose the Equal Rights Amendment at home in the United States. Do you have any idea how she could have reconciled these conflicting stances?
I believe that Mrs. Roosevelt genuinely believed in the equal rights of everybody. But I also think, because she was an ardent Democrat, she could not support the Equal Rights Amendment as introduced by Alice Paul in 1923.
So it's a political conversation that we will have to pick up right after the break.
Let's return now to The Ballot Box with your hosts, Tamar Tate and Nita Lubin, brought to you by the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle. Once again, The Ballot Box on 1460 WVOX.
Welcome back. We are with Elizabeth Betsy Griffith, author of the book Formidable, The Last 100 Years of Women's History in the United States. We were talking about Eleanor Roosevelt and the fact that she was, in fact, a firm believer in equality for all, supporting the United, leading the United Nations Human Rights Commission, supporting the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, however, could not fully accept the Equal Rights Amendment at home in the U.S. So, Betsy, please continue.
Eleanor could not endorse the Equal Rights Amendment initially because it had been introduced as a partisan measure by Republicans. It was the brainchild, the initiative of Alice Paul. Paul represents the third generation of suffrage activists. You've got Stanton, Anthony, Sojourner Truth, the grandmothers who are all dead, Harriet Chapman Catt, founds the League of Women Voters, brilliant strategist, and Alice Paul is the one who brings outdoor tactics from her experience in England. The parades, the pageants, the pickets were all her idea, but also because she had spent years in England, she had a parliamentary attitude about politics, that you held the party in power responsible for change. But suffrage never would have passed had it not gotten bipartisan support. She, however, never changes her point of view. So in 1923, she has two Republicans introduce the Equal Rights Amendment. So the first reason to oppose it was partisan. It was an issue that Democrats were not going to like because Republicans had introduced it. The second reason was that at that time, the Equal Rights Amendment would have removed the protective legislation that Democrats' social activists had worked so hard to enact to protect women. Every time they tried to protect men and women in equal protection, the courts knocked down the parts covering men. So women got restrooms, women got fewer hours to work, women were not supposed to be dragging coal carts on their hands and knees through mines because they were the future mothers of America. It took a long time for labor unions to resolve that, really into the late 60s and 70s, before they changed their attitude about protective labor legislation. So between the issues about what the impact of the ERA would have been and the partisan nature of its support, Roosevelt had great difficulty supporting it. And in the early 1960s, President Kennedy, backed by labor and a Democrat, rather than come out and support the Equal Rights Amendment, convened a commission on the status of women, and it was stuffed with anti-ERA people, chaired by Eleanor Roosevelt, until she dies. And only they had one member, an attorney, Margaret Raywalt, was a supporter of the Equal Rights Amendment. And because of that, the commission's report said, we do not need an Equal Rights Amendment now. And she introduces now. Mm-hmm. But within just a few years, Martha Griffiths, Democrat from Michigan, will manage to get the Equal Rights Amendment onto the floor of the House, and it will pass in 1972 with enormous bipartisan support and a lot of positive activity until the situation changes with the Roe v. Wade decision, and that stirs up much more opposition to women's rights throughout the 70s. Right.
And here we are now in 2022, still without an Equal Rights Amendment.
So, yeah, and I think the answer to my question, you're saying, Betsy, is that, in fact, Eleanor Roosevelt did fight to the very end to bring in a rational, thoughtful Equal Rights Amendment.
The other fascinating thing to me about Eleanor Roosevelt, because we all think, I have a chapter titled The Eleanor Effect. She had enormous mm-hmm. influence, but it's the influence of moral authority. She didn't succeed in a lot of things related to Jewish refugees, related to lynching laws, things that she wanted to advance. Mm-hmm. And she couldn't because Franklin was not, was really beholden to Southern senators. So he was also hampered in what he could do by the power of a regional, I was about to say a regional racism, but that's deeper than that in our country.
Yeah. You mentioned the 1970s, and for me there was very interesting information in the 70s and 80s. In particular, the ERA, a deep dive into Phyllis Schlafly and Reagan. And I again recommend all this and all of these chapters to listeners. But you did close that chapter on the 80s and 90s with, what were those words, Tamar?
You wrote, nothing came without a fight against opponents, among allies, between races and classes. Women had never been a unified cohort, and by the 1990s, your division seemed sharper. Could you describe the divisions in the 1980s and 1990s and perhaps during other decades of the past 100 years?
There have always been divisions. It's a myth that women are a unified, monolithic political group. Women are so diverse as men, as diverse as every citizen in our country, depending on your race, your ethnicity, your religion, the region you live in, whether you're married, whether you're a mother, what your gender identity is, what your access to opportunity has been, your life experience, all of those things define who you are. So you have different interests. In 1920, when the 19th Amendment finally passes, and it passes because Kat has been able to pull together very briefly a multiracial, multiethnic, age-wide coalition, it splinters because all of those people wanted suffrage for different reasons. White women wanted it for social justice, for maternal and health benefits. They wanted to advance the rights of immigrants and factory workers. Some of them wanted to support the Equal Rights Amendment. Others had no interest in politics and wanted to build birth control clinics. Black women had an entirely different agenda. starting with protecting their community from racial violence, from lynching, from Jim Crow discrimination. So women have always had a lot of interest, and when they do not, and one could make a case that there are lots of alliances to be made among those interests, but they got into a pattern of working independently and separately and not cooperating very often. When they cooperate, when we can bring more groups together, we manage to get more passed in by building coalitions and finding allies. But that's a challenge to do. I think contemporary times, I think the issues coming from this summer and the Supreme Court decision create opportunities for some new alliances, and maybe we'll see those build in the same way that we're seeing more people register.
Are you optimistic?
Well, I'm an optimistic person, but when you came of age in the 70s, how fortunate to graduate on the cusp of this renewed interest in women's and civil rights, things worked. You know, the government found ways to compromise and come together and find bipartisan solutions. And people who protested ended up writing legislation. So because that's my background, I am optimistic. But also, I think, you know, America's been... It's the world's oldest democracy now, and we've had a lot of crises that we have survived, and every one has threatened the fabric of the nation. I think where we are now is another very challenging time, and so people need to think about what's most important to our country and how to safeguard it so that we can have these debates and fights without pulling apart the basis of our country.
Hear, hear. Before we close, Betsy, a final question. The Formidable's epilogue is called Not Enough, and you have already suggested that accomplishments have been many, but it is not enough. Can you give us a quick list, a very brief and quick list of where you think work is needed?
Everywhere.
Okay. Okay, that'll do it.
The fact that women still, the majority of women work in the lowest paid jobs. We do not have accessible, affordable child care, enough family leave. Our maternal and infant health statistics are abysmal and are riven by racial discrimination. Women are the largest number of, we're the majority of the population, the majority of registered voters, the majority of voters who turn out. And we are not well represented in any governing body. So we have a lot more work to do.
We do, Betsy. Thank you.
Betsy, thank you so much for your time, your thoughtful comments, and your significant contribution to documenting the history of this country. We strongly recommend to our listeners you pick up a copy of Formidable, American Women and the Fight for Equality, and settle in with this book that is essentially a 3-credit course on women in American history. And it's even more just great reading. Join us for our next show, Wednesday, October 19th. And have a great day, everyone.